From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
As the rhetoric around the Korean Peninsula and in Washington heats up, we look at the actual possibilities of nuclear conflict and, more revealingly, the context for the current crisis with Professor Tony Montero. Tony, let's start with the DPRK.
Yes, definitely, because that's the latest and most recent flashpoint in international and world events. And at the same time, it is kind of a moment that can decide the fate of the American empire in Asia, in the East Asian zone of world politics. I think that the DPRK government has a legitimate position. It is developing nuclear weapons not as an offensive tool, but to defend itself against a nation, a government, a regime here in the United States that has never given up on regime change in the North. From the time of the Clinton administration up through the Obama administration and now with the Trump administration, there's been a common and singular theme, nuclear war with North Korea if the North Korean regime does not surrender and carry out regime change on itself. That is, to overthrow its principles, the principles upon which the regime and the state in North Korea are established, and that is the building of socialism, a state-controlled economy, an end to poverty and inequality, and on and on and on, all of those things that we have identified with real socialism in the world. And what the West is saying is that we want that overthrown and the, quote, reunification of the Korean Peninsula under under capitalist organization of the economy and as a almost a neo-colony, if not a vassal state of the United States, which would mean that, and this is the bigger picture, that U.S. Military forces would be right on the border of China and Russia. Now, from that standpoint, one is puzzled, at least I am, by the appeasement policies of China and Russia. You know, these sanctions, the most recent ones, but most of them, for the most part, have done nothing to deter the aggressive military posture of the United States in Korea and towards the DPRK in particular. So, we're at a very critical point. I think this is the most dangerous that it has ever been because the North Korean government and nation is now more able to defend itself through deterrence and including nuclear deterrence, that if they are struck, they are able to strike back. And I think what is also recognized is that the South Korean people are becoming increasingly exhausted with the U.S. policy of aggression against the North. And of course, all of the Korean people look with deep skepticism at the role of Japan in all of these military operations against North Korea.
Yeah. It's You look at the coverage, and I was watching yesterday, for example, the State Department that had a press conference. It was unusual because they had kind of settled into a pattern of holding them twice a week on Tuesday and Thursday, and this week instead they had it on Wednesday, and it was there was no Tuesday. Anyway, it was backed up, and this whole thing is unfolding around the press conference, including the statements that came out of Trump about, you know, you start something, this is what's going to happen to you, and then they're issuing a statement talking about, well, if you do that, we're going to do this, which, you know, in my mind, is a hell of a lot better than showing what you're going to do, as has been done before. It seemed the entire press corps yesterday was out to make Trump look like an irresponsible maniac for talking like this, but I'm looking at what's been done by the you know, pillars of normalcy that they hold up. You know, well, this is unprecedented language. Yeah, well, what did Bush do? What did Obama do? What did Clinton do? You know, take a look at, you want to go to Yugoslavia or Iraq or Libya, you know, though maybe they didn't say much. Maybe they said flowery stuff about democracy, but the ground is smoldering and there are charred bodies everywhere. So I'd rather hear somebody talk nonsense.
Well, you know, yeah, the fact of the matter is Trump's words are irresponsible. But, and I agree with you, the actions of the U.S. Military and U.S. governments going back, especially to Clinton, up to the present, of threatening nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula. Now, of course, these are threats that I don't think they can carry through with, because as we have said over and over and over again, two of the three largest economies in the world are in that area. Three of the five largest economies are there. The fifth largest economy in the world is South Korea. But the other thing about it is that North Korea, in spite of the sanctions, in spite of the threats, has moved forward to further modernize and industrialize and bring advanced technology into their economy. Their military achievements are not disconnected from the overall industrialization and modernization and including advanced technology into their economy. Right. North Korea is not a basket case by any means.
Nope.
They have not imported the technology for the most part to produce the weapons that they have produced.
Right.
And the fact that they can carry out these missile tests in spite of the U.S. Cyber war against North Korea is itself a great accomplishment.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think if I might just say this, Don.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, Trump's words are irresponsible, but they are not any different in substance from the words that have been iterated by everybody from Clinton to Obama as late as last year. However, it does seem that the military has taken charge of a lot that is going on in Korea. And that's why this buildup on Guam of aircraft, two nuclear aircraft carriers and the submarines and cruisers that are part of these aircraft carrier groups, and the B-1B bombers and all of that is, of course, a new provocation, a new level of provocation. Now, the irony of it is, you know, the obvious target is North Korea. However, it is the reassertion of American military power in Northeast Asia, and one would also say the South China Sea. This is also directed against China. The THAAD missiles in South Korea are not defensive only. They're also offensive weapons. And they're directed at China. So I don't understand the Chinese policy of appeasement because it is not deterring American aggression against North Korea or ultimately against China.
Or Russia. And, you know,
that's what we're going to get to in a minute.
So let me touch a couple things that you just did first. Because not just is North Korea or DPRK not a basket case, but if you look at the, you know, as you say, you have South Korea or Republic of Korea is, you know, one of the five largest economies in the world.
Yes.
And the population in the north is about half the population in the south. In other words, about a third of Korea lives north of the 38th parallel. And if you think about that country unified as an economic powerhouse, look at it in relation to Japan and China looking over its shoulder too, back at it. Everybody looking at, and meanwhile, an independent unified Korea would relate to the United States much differently than South Korea, you know, occupied Korea has related to the United States since, you know, the early 1950s or 1945 even. So that dynamic that takes place, and, you know, we have the election that just took place in South Korea where, you know, the candidate who was talking about peace and even rapprochement with the North won popular vote, is a popular figure in the country, as are those ideas in South Korea. You know, the U.S., foothold on the Asian continent in Korea at the border of Russia and China, in essence, across the little bay there, that thing is at risk. And you're looking at a real reconfiguration of economic power globally and of the U.S. economic relationship to Asia and the U.S. military relationship to Asia changing depending on what happens in Korea. So the stakes for the United States in Korea are extremely high, and most of it has very little to do with Kim and missiles and nuclear weapons. That's first. Secondly, the installation of the THAAD missile system, which is a high-altitude missile defense, quote-unquote. I mean, it's an offensive weapon in that if I take out your offensive capability, I can blast you with mine, which is what the point of it is. So it's a part of the offensive weapon system. But its placement where it is a defense against launches from Russia or China against the United States or Japan. And so it is clearly targeting them. Everybody who's sitting looking at their weapons inventories and at the defensive measures or the countermeasures that they have to deal with, sitting in any chair, whether it's in Pyongyang, Moscow, Beijing, or elsewhere, they all know what those weapons are there for and what their actual mission is going to be when they're utilized. So there's no question about that anywhere except in the U.S. media. And then the final thing I wanted to say is I am still reeling over how obvious it is with this media here in the U.S. now, where the entire press corps yesterday, all they wanted to do was make Trump's statement look irrational. Nobody's contextualizing it with, A, all the people that they were invoking because they said it was unprecedented have actually done these horrible things and, you know, destroyed. I'd mentioned three presidents in three countries that were destroyed. And we don't know yet. As it stands, Trump's public statements are an end to regime change. And with respect to Korea, let's sit down with Kim and talk. They're attacking him where it relates to Russia or where it relates in a number of places as being either weak or compromised. And so, however tough he talks, I'd like to see what the actual policy is before judging it. And I certainly don't want to judge it based on the critique coming from the people who laid the groundwork for the destruction of Yugoslavia and Iraq and Libya and Syria and elsewhere.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, there is a divide within the administration, if you take Trump out of it for a minute, between Tillerson and Mattis. Tillerson has said we are not for regime change, and this is a profound concern for the DPRK government.
It's the raison for the missiles and the nuclear weapons. They don't want to be regime changed.
That's right. And of course, there is already a plan in place, a U.S. plan in place called to behead, and they refer to it that way, to behead the North Korean regime.
Right.
That is to attack and kill Kim Jong-un and the top military and political leadership of the nation. So that's already in place, and North Korea is very aware of it. Mattis is an advocate of that, and he keeps warning, as he did most recently a couple of days ago, North Korea, that the U.S. and its allies have overwhelming power and would immediately destroy North Korea.
That's the word he used, yep.
Yeah, but Obama said something very, very similar as late as last year, 2016.
Right.
So these threats are not new. I agree that the picture has to be, the frame of vision has to be expanded. We're not just talking about North Korea. We're talking about Northeast Asia.
Yeah.
And therefore, we're talking about China and Russia. And in fact, to isolate North Korea, which in spite of all the sanctions, in spite of all the arm twisting on the part of the West and the United States, has had some important successes in its soft power program. In other words, North Korea is not totally isolated.
Right.
Its trade with China between 2016 January and 2017 January increased by almost 37%.
Wow.
China, that part of China that is near to North Korea and North Korea are inseparable economically. It's a single economic zone.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go to Africa, the North Koreans have positive relationships with a number of nations in Africa, including Zambia and Mozambique and Angola and other countries where they provide technological assistance in the development programs of these nations. And I think that as far as Asia is concerned, the Asian governments and people do not look upon North Korea as a threat. They see the U.S. military as a threat. And this is everywhere from Okinawa to the Philippines and including North Korea. In fact, North Korea is seen by many nations in the developing world, as it is called, as a model of how to defend your sovereignty and integrity. And don't think that most nations of the world have forgotten what happened in Libya and Iraq.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the last thing that you mentioned is another leg that this stands on. When you were speaking about the decapitation plans of the United States, what that does is demonstrate the U.S. proposed model for what happens on the Korean Peninsula. You decapitate the North and have it absorbed into South Korea and maintain control of South Korea. And so now you have this massive economy and political unit situated between Japan and China and at the border of Russia and China. And so that's the model that they're moving towards. And along with that, you have to suppress the example of this model that's being propagated by North Korea successfully defending its sovereignty in the face of the United States' massive attack on its sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
So that
mm-hmm.
those things, that's the U.S. game that's going on there. The, you know, the Korean people themselves seek, you know, unification of their country and, you know, peaceful development, and I assume being able to keep the fruits of their labor. You have a very active labor movement even in the South, despite
right.
the fascist governments that were military occupation that were imposed on South mm-hmm. Korea, and you have, you know, the communist government in the North. So mm-hmm. the potential for the development of that peninsula by the Koreans themselves is very, very great. It's just, and then China, of course, looking at this, and Japan, this is a traditional geopolitical rival in Asia,
mm-hmm.
And China is integrating itself with both the North and the South economically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, but at any rate, you know, this is a pattern of U.S. policy.
Yep.
I think, you know, often war is a, or the threat of war is a domestic political weapon as well.
Yeah.
Of course, we know that Trump has never been a favorite of the military, nor of the big transnational banks and corporations who saw his withdrawing of the TPP as kind of eviscerating U.S. economic thrust or turn towards Asia. I mean, this was huge. He's not been forgiven for that.
I mean, if you look at the TPP, you know, the people who were running the TPP as bank robbers and the national treasury and relations with China and everyone else as the bank, you know, well, when he stopped that bank robbery, those are the bank robbers, to be able to describe it.
Oh, yeah.
That was their money that they weren't allowed, you know, that it was their attempted theft of our money that was thwarted, basically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And don't forget, during the 2016 election, Clinton painted Trump as an ally of Kim Jong-un.
Right.
And he had some kind words to say about the North Korean government or the leader of North Korea.
Yep.
And he said certain kind things about Trump. So under pressure and the chaos of the White House, and it is in chaos, believe me, what we call the deep state has moved strategically. The danger is that there are no controls and no accountability at this point, as small as they've been, upon military operations in Asia and in Northeast Asia and other parts of the world. In other words, the war makers, I think, are running amok under conditions of political chaos at the top of the American government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like it. It's for a guy who ran on a promise, popular promise, and stuck with it despite massive public relations attack of no regime change and rapprochement. Mm-hmm. And we're talking here also about the, you know, overtures made to the DPRK by Trump during the campaign. You know, just not saying let's nuke them is an overture compared to the political climate in the United States. And Clinton essentially saying, let's do that. She didn't voice those words, but she staked out very aggressive policy, mm-hmm. and she was criticizing Trump, as you referenced, for talking about the idea of sitting down and negotiating.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So the climate itself, you know, that's been created by the people Trump has at the head of the military, the people that are in control of the intelligence agencies, the people in control of the arms committees in both houses of Congress, and mm-hmm. and the bulk of the membership of both houses of Congress.
That's if we really wanted to know, get a sense of what's going on in the American government, you have to look to that that bill which was passed in the House and Senate for new sanctions against Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Yeah. And it was a bill that took that took the teeth out of the presidency in terms of the execution of war and peace. In other words, Trump was made powerless in a lot of ways by that bill, which was a veto-proof bill with the numbers that voted for it. So that tells us everything. This is why I find it quite difficult to explain, in this instance, the Russian policy of appeasement of the United States, because they were included in the sanctions, the new sanctions of the United States against North Korea and Iran. They're put in the same empire of evil basket. But I think the North Korean government and the people of the DPRK have to be applauded for their resoluteness, because they're waging a just struggle It is a struggle for world peace and really for civilization, standing up to the aggressor. Appeasing the aggressor does not bring peace. It only encourages them. The other thing I would say is that the CIA and of course the military is not of one mind, even with respect to North Korea, are attempting to make a statement about what they want domestic politics to look like. In other words, like you mentioned, the press conference at the State Department, where the State Department was trying to explain Trump's words, etc. Well, the fact of the matter is, to have Trump in that position where the State Department has to separate itself from his words is itself a political act against Trump himself, which means he doesn't even control the State Department. He's like on an island, I think, and he's damned if he does, he's damned if he doesn't do, you know?
Yeah, well, that's where they're trying to put him for sure. Yeah,
yeah. I think he's there. I think he's there. And we might differ on this. Mm. And really what they're doing, they're really looking towards 2020. They got to make sure this guy is not reelected. And you can't rule his reelection out,
for
by
sure.
the way.
Yeah, for
but,
sure.
But he's being smeared on every side.
Yep. You know, on that last point, I forget where I saw it. It was somewhere in the media in the last 24 hours. The person who was speaking was reciting the polling data and the other media assessment of his possibility, you know, possible election. Back up to election day, and reminded me listening to this, and this person specifically mentioned this. The New York Times, as of the election day, was speculating they had odds, you know, from the experts on the likelihood of Trump being elected, because there was this narrow path of daylight. I forget what the term of art they used was. And it was 0.0 something
right.
percent.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And not 0.0 something chance, but 0.0 something percent chance. In other words, like tens of 1 in 10,000 or 5 in 10,000 chance that he could be elected. And then even after Clinton semi-conceded, you know, to the extent she conceded that night, that the chance of him being elected was still only about 95% on that same thing. So,
well,
you know,
yeah.
what their ability to prognosticate for 2020, I think, is pretty limited at this point.
Well, yeah, because, you know, everything, or most things, I won't say everything, but a lot is in the hands of the American people. And the American people are unhappy with Russiagate. They're unhappy with the corporate Democrats.
Yep.
They're unhappy with their economic situation. They're being told that everything is rosy, and they're not seeing it that way.
That's right.
There is a smoldering rebellion among young people who have moved to the left and further to the left, a generational shift. And that's why, you know, they're calling for socialism all over the place and for peace. So everything is in the hands of, well, most things I would say are in the hands of the masses of American people,
right.
Who we don't hear from in the corporate media. But if you're out here in the streets, if you're among people, you hear it all the time. Deep dissatisfaction.
And I think that's going to show us going forward. That's going to determine what happens to a large degree. Tony, thank you very much. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Don. Take care.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.